je voudrais tant que tu comprennes. Puisque notre amour va finir, que malgré tout, vois-tu, je t'aime et que j'ai mal.
Sommes plus très loin de la grange et de l'eau.
reste qu'une lieue pour Marion. Debout mon vieux, lève-toi, je ne rentre pas sans toi. Je veux bien t'aider, mais ne tire pas. On peut même s'arrêter, car avant d'être arrivé, il n'y a plus que 300 pas pour Marianne. Il n'y a plus que 300 pas pour Marianne. Le vent du nord est tombé, et quand le jour s'est levé, près de son cheval, on l'a retrouvé, avec ses deux mains collées, sur la glace d'un rocher. Il dormait à quelques pas de Marianne.
Kamel, why, Gamela? We tongue at the la, a cut tongue, a ring, a, oh. Hang reassurance that will make you cry.
I will always wonder what it feels like being yours. A fever dream.
A woman, you make me so weak.
If I never met you, it would be easier. But worse though, you're so special. Can't decide if you're dangerous or sweet.
'Cause I'm a freak, and you know it. You make me hate myself. This is a phase for supersonic. Yeah, I'm a freak, and I know that you love it. Hope you can handle me, 'cause if we crash, we fall apart. Don't wanna lose ya. Yeah.
You, I'm in love. Who do I love? Though you're so perfect, so fragile, unreal.
Are you scared of loving me? Don't I deserve you loving me? I'm freaking out. I need you now. I miss you now. I'm such a fucking weirdo.
She spat it out, words are not allowed. She just wants to feel beautiful in a world that is so hateful. She's always waking up before sunrise. Movie match, it's a good life. Everybody wants to be like her. Everybody wants to look like her. Because nobody knows that she's really hurt. Every
your fears, just act tough. Being if it's not enough, your mistake, just keep it fake. Lying to their face, what they really hate is when you show them your weaknesses. They don't want any deepness here, so.
Shakes and begs for a break, counting every calorie. I don't wanna end up living in a dive on fire. A dive on fire. A hostess is doing gossip magazine crosswords and a flight to JFK. 39 years old with a mile high sheen, trying to stimulate. Jump up and say, lady, I know why your thoughts turn gray. Hollywood infected your brain, you wanna kiss it in the rain. Oh, oh, living in a movie scene, puking American dreams. Oh, oh, I'm obsessed with the mess that's America.
صفای من عزیز روزهای نو از مهر تو جان میگیرد این خانه کوچیکه پر صلح و صفای من در ده سر و مشکل نیست در کنار تو بودن حساب و معما نیست با هزار پیچ و خم در ده سر و مشکل نیست در کنار تو بودن حساب و معما نیست با هزار پیچ و خم این رود روان تا هر جا که برد کشتی من را در کنار تو من شدم امروز و فردا این رود روان تا هر جا که برد کشتی من را در کنار تو من شدم امروز و فردا Daddy
های تازه جای درد و غم نیست، دست گرفتیم از آن زخم های قدیمی، حالا وقت آن رسیده که من و تو دست در دست هم با موج ها برقصیم. عزیز روزهای نو از مهر تو جان میگیرد این خانه کوچیک پر صلح و صفای من. عزیز روزهای نو از مهر تو جان میگیرد این خانه کوچیک پر صلح و صفای من. این روح بروان تا هر جا که برد کشتی من را، در کنار تو من شادم امروز و فردا. روان تا هر جا که برد کشتی من را، در کنار تو من شادم امروز و فردا. کشتی من را در کنار تو من شادم امروز و فردا. این رود روان تا هر جا که برد کشتی من را، در کنار تو من شادم امروز و فردا.
Well, I'm hoping that it's prophetic that I call this episode A Tale of Two Last Wars. There was the Soviet Union's war in Afghanistan, which was its last foreign war, and, obviously, Putin's war in Ukraine, that I sincerely hope, but also believe, will be his last foreign war. Let's just look at some of the comparisons. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. Now, the alert listener will have picked up on the fact that this is out of the usual time frame. Generally speaking, I like to record my podcasts at the weekend, but this past weekend I was recording the patron special Q&A, and because I'm travelling, the next two weekends I'm not going to be able to do anything. So I thought I would do something even so heretical as on a Wednesday. It's Wednesday the 26th of July. And for patrons, by the way, you will still get something in the next couple of weeks. I'm not sure if it'll be audio or just simply written, but I will not forget you. Anyway, to go on to this comparison, which in many ways just emerged from a Twitter thread that I sort of threw out a few days back, in which I compared the casualty figures between these two conflicts, and I'll come on to that in a moment. But although in many ways they're terribly different wars, what I do want to do is compare the Soviet war in Afghanistan and the Russian war in Ukraine really for the effects they had on their respective countries as much as the sort of details of the differences of scale and such like. Given that I appreciate that 1979 to 1988 Afghan war may not be at the top of everyone's consciousness, let me just give you a very quick run through. So, on Christmas 1979, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. They invaded in some ways reluctantly. It's not actually this is ever their plan, but they invaded because they saw two things. One was that Afghanistan, under the deeply clumsy and vicious rule of the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, was increasingly collapsing into chaos, and there was a rising Islamist rebel movement. So there was this sense that essentially that government in Kabul was going to fall, and there was a fear that in fact, it was going to fall to a regime which could in due course find some kind of a deal with the Americans. So what they intended to do was just simply a surgical operation to eliminate the existing leader, Hafizullah Amin, a deeply unpleasant man, replace him with the relatively, and I would underscore that, relatively moderate Babrak Karmal, do a show of force just to basically demonstrate to the rebels that they shouldn't mess around, they should appreciate that they're part of the Soviet Union's sphere of influence and accept it, and then within 6 months, withdraw, leaving behind a stabilised PDPA regime, a cowed country, and a safe subject nation. Does that sound at all familiar? Now, of course, there are huge differences between the Afghan and Ukrainian wars. Not least the fact that the Afghan war essentially remained a medium to low intensity counterinsurgency war. It was not a straightforward struggle. It was definitely closer to the kind of counterinsurgency experiences the West had in, well, Afghanistan, but also Iraq. Whereas, obviously, in Ukraine, we really can define this as a straightforward state versus state nation, and increasingly one with parity or indeed technological superiority going to the Ukrainians. Well, that said, though, there are certain similarities. I mean, first of all, just in the initial concept. And it's worth noting that the Soviets were actually very effective in how they seized Kabul, eliminated Amin, and I suppose I should add in a little pitch here. My book, Storm 333, KGB and Spetsnaz Seize Kabul, Soviet-Afghan War, 1979, gives you all the details you might want about that, and I'm sure a hell of a lot more, including it's the very first time I've ever actually had to produce art notes for an illustration showing an execution, but that's another matter. So they very neatly did that. They sent in their troops, they seized all the main cities of Afghanistan and the main ring highway. But the point is, they had misunderstood the nature of the country. They thought that this was going to be like, 1968 and the conquest of Czechoslovakia. That essentially the cities were what counted, whereas, of course, Afghanistan is a very different country, in which arguably the countryside and the cities have been at odds, if not at war, for most of the period. So that didn't work. But still, let's say, in terms of its initial conception, however misguided that conception was, the Soviet invasion worked in a way that obviously the initial conception of the invasion of Ukraine was a devastating mistake. But still, what are the similarities? First of all, essentially increasingly gerontocratic leaders, aging leaders, out of touch with how the world has changed, not really with any clear sense of what was actually happening on the ground. And frankly, we're operating off deeply flawed notions of what these countries were. We now have a wealth of documents, in terms of sort of Politburo discussions and briefing papers and the like. And it's clear that the discussions in 1979, on the one hand, it was quite realistic in the sense that actually the Soviet leadership didn't want to go into Afghanistan. It was trying to avoid it. And it was only when they decided that it was unavoidable that they actually felt, well, that's when they needed to have a decapitating strike against the PDPA's leadership, because Amin was just so brutal and trying to essentially reshape the country, a country that didn't want to be reshaped at breakneck speed, that he was actually becoming the problem. But generally speaking, there was so much misunderstanding about the nature of the country and the nature of the situation, and a willingness to ignore the military's own perspectives. It's quite striking that unlike Gerasimov, who seems to have been entirely willing just to keep his mouth shut and nod along as if he were some little bobbing head puppet on the dashboard of the car Putin was driving towards the precipice, well, his counterparts at the time, people like Chief of the General Staff Marshal Agarkov or General Akhramayev, who later on would also become Chief of the General Staff, they were very, very keenly aware of just how badly suited the Soviet military, designed as it was for big mass mechanized clashes on the plains of Europe or perhaps even northern China, was for this kind of scrappy counterinsurgency in a country with a lot of very, very high mountains and generally rough relief. But the point is, not only were they not able to get through to the leadership, they were actively suppressed. The defense minister, Marshal Ustinov, who was not a military man despite his chest full of medals, again, certain reminiscences of the current incumbent, But Ustinov was a drinking buddy of Brezhnev's, didn't want to disappoint him, and actually barred Agarkov from directly briefing the Politburo and saying all the things that remained unsaid. So Ustinov was blandly promising Brezhnev that it would be basically a walk in the park, even while his own generals were warning him of what a mistake it would be. But the point is, this was driven not so much by these kind of practical assumptions, but by a very zero-sum notion of world politics. Remember, this was just after the Iranian Revolution, so there was genuine fear about sort of Islam on the march, and there was a fear that if Afghanistan went jihadist, then that would in due course infect, quote-unquote, the Central Asian parts of the Soviet Union. But more to the point, there was this belief that essentially countries, all that really matters is who controls them, who owns them, for want of a better word. And there was a certain amount of, frankly, nonsense, but nonetheless, reporting from the local KGB resident in Kabul and others to the effect that Amin was contemplating, if the Soviets weren't going to give him the assistance he would want, he would actually turn to the Americans. And so it was this sense of basically, if we don't control it, the Americans will. And if the Americans do, then they'll be able to have radar bases and missile stations, right in our southern flank. So, there was that degree to which it was that notion that not only that where a red flag is unfurled, it cannot be brought down, but also that ultimately it's to stop the Americans from getting it. And a final particular point that's worth noting about Afghanistan is the degree to which it actually needed leadership change to end the war. I mean, Brezhnev started the war. Soon thereafter he dies. Yuri Andropov, who takes over. Andropov had always had a rather ambivalent position. On the one hand, he was actually quite sceptical about invading Afghanistan. But at the same time, he was positioning himself to be General Secretary. And it seems to be that he didn't feel he could afford to look half-hearted in his support of Soviet interests and the cause of the revolution, and therefore he also was one of the forces ultimately pushing for this intervention while trying to keep it limited. When he became General Secretary, he began to actually try and see if there was room for some kind of negotiated withdrawal, but the point is he very quickly succumbed to his kidneys, spent most of his very brief tenure as General Secretary plugged into a dialysis machine, didn't have what in modern terms we would call the bandwidth to be able to do anything about it. Ultimately, it would be not his immediate successor, Chernyenko, but then Gorbachev, who would actually broker a withdrawal. But the point is, again, it needed someone else in the Kremlin, someone who ultimately, explicitly or not, could more or less say, this was someone else's war. This is the interesting thing, that Gorbachev could legitimately say that he was not part of any of the discussions about the invasion. So that's something to bear in mind. So why was I sort of drawing this comparison beyond, obviously, there's these general points? Well, the specific point I was making was actually about participation rates and casualty rates. All told, about 1 million Soviets at some point or another cycled through service in Afghanistan in the course of this 10-year war. Most of them were soldiers, but some of them were civilians. Everyone from doctors and engineers who were drafted in to run clinics and build roads to, even people like the Aeroflot pilots who were often pressed into service bringing troops in. And so even though they were on civilian planes, they had to run the gauntlet of anti-aircraft missiles and the like. So 1 million Soviets out of a total population of about 285 million. Which means, roughly speaking, a 0.35% participation rate over 10 years. Now, if one looks at the Russian involvement in Ukraine, I mean, first of all, obviously Russia is much smaller than the Soviet Union. It was only one part of the Soviet Union. But so far, it seems to have sent about 500,000 people to the war. Now, some people have suggested that figure is too low. I'm not convinced, because I think that some of the figures we've had about, for example, how many troops the Russians had built up around the borders at the beginning of the war were exaggerated. Anyway, your figures may vary, but mine is about 500,000 Russians have been through or are currently in Ukraine. Of course, that's out of a population of 143 million or so, which, when you look at it, again, means something like a 0.35% participation rate. So already and after all, the war is by no means, alas, over. Already, Russians have, shall we say, experienced war in Ukraine to the same degree that Soviets experienced war in Afghanistan, and as I said, it's only continuing. But perhaps even more telling should be considered the death rates. In the full 10 years of the Afghan war, the Soviets lost, roughly speaking, 15,000 people. So far, in what, the first year and a half or so of the war in Ukraine, the Russians have lost, well, again, figures vary, but let's be conservative and put it at around 50,000. I mean, some people say it's double that, which I think is way over the odds. But anyway, if we say 50,000, what this means is that the death rate in Afghanistan was 1.5%. So in other words, for every 100 soldiers who went into Afghanistan, 1.5 would not make it home. What about Ukraine then? We're talking about 10% there. I mean, this is devastating. One last bit of statistical comparison. Let's think of this in terms of the death rate as a proportion of the population. In Afghanistan, it was 0.005%, which again, I think, helps give a sense of the degree to which this was politically shocking, socially impactful, but ultimately, in grand terms, not very significant event. It's worth noting, after all, that at peak, 40,000 Soviets died in road accidents per year. Compare that to an average of 1,500 dying in Afghanistan. But what about Russians in Ukraine? Well, here the death rate is 0.035%. Now, again, statistically, not that big, but it's seven times higher than the war in Afghanistan. So let's think about what are the likely effects of all this conflict. And let me start. I mean, I think I'll probably take a break in a moment. But before I do, let me insert one absolutely necessary and, at one point in my life, deeply depressing caveat. Afghanistan, the war in Afghanistan, did not bring down the Soviet Union. You'll often see kind of neat little assertions to that effect, because after all, you know, the war in Afghanistan goes through until 1988. Soviet Union, by that point, is already in terminal decline and is wound up at the end of 1991. Look, I did my PhD on the impact of the Afghan war on the Soviet Union. And so this inevitable, very human, I would say, desire for the subject of your PhD to be of truly world-shaping importance. And so, you know, as I did my research, it was with a growing sense of despondency that I had to appreciate that it wasn't, that it did not bring down the Soviet Union. It was actually, in many ways, a relatively bearable cost, especially when compared with so many others. However, that does not mean that it was not significant in other ways. And above all, what really mattered was the way that the Afghan war became a metaphor, shall we say, a way of talking about all the other things that you felt were wrong with the Soviet Union. So when you were talking about Afghanistan and, let's say, the bad decision making, it was actually also just simply a way of saying that we are run by fools and incompetents who don't care about us. When you're talking about the plight of Afghan veterans coming back and not getting the necessary medical assistance and social assistance that they needed, it was also a way of talking about just generally the collapse, frankly, of the Soviet health system and the fact that corruption had become so deeply ingrained that you had to pay to get anything like what you're entitled to. Or indeed, Afghanistan was used as a way of acceptably talking about your local ethnicity's feeling that it is especially heavily oppressed and exploited by the Soviet leadership. So in other words, actually a whole gamut of different criticisms, concerns and complaints that people had about the system could be aired and discussed by apparently talking about Afghanistan. And in some ways, this ended up being good for the veterans because it allowed their own issues and situations to be aired. But also, often, it was actually deeply problematic because it really meant that their real concerns got hijacked by wider discussions. So what I'm going to do is, after the break, is go through a variety of areas in which actually, based on what the Afghan experience can tell us, we can explore what this war may mean for the Russian Federation. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. So let me start by picking up on that last point, which is the ethnic politics. Because, as I say, what I found fascinating when I was doing my field research, this was in the period of 1988 to 91, which ironically was a great time to do field research, miserable time to be in the Soviet Union, but it was a great time to do research for the simple reason that people understood that the old rules, the old constraints no longer applied, but didn't know what the new ones were. So to a degree, you could get away with anything as long as you acted confident and just basically said that it had been approved somewhere else. Anyway, the thing that struck me was when talking to particularly veterans, but also other observers from different constituent republics of the Soviet Union, was that pretty much everywhere I experienced the same thing, which is people would say, the thing is, our boys are being sent there disproportionately. We are suffering greater losses. We are experiencing a greater burden. And in some cases, but not always, but there was a direct corollary, which is, and this is being done by the Kremlin specifically to bleed our people, to take away the best and the brightest of our young men. So it was almost the sense that it was some kind of long-term deliberate genocide. Now, that was always something that's very difficult to actually assess, because the Soviets never put out participation rates that were broken down by nationality or by the region from which they came. However, I did one day manage to find casualty rates, which were broken down by republic, by constituent republic. And the fascinating thing is there, when I put together the casualty rates with the share of the overall Soviet population, they actually correlated pretty directly. There were some slight disproportions, I mean Turkmens, but in part that's because, for the reasons of surprise, the initial invading force had been drawn from the Turkmenistan military district, so that they were particularly heavily involved in the first wave. And actually Russians and Ukrainians, but again that was because they were disproportionately represented amongst the paratroopers, who basically were used for a lot of the toughest fighting. But the Balts, the Georgians and so forth, who were so convinced that they were the ones who were suffering the most, actually they basically were participating at the level one would expect, or indeed in some cases actually just below that level. So what was happening is, again, that people made assumptions about how the state treated them, and they overlaid those assumptions onto the realities of Afghanistan. And this is particularly interesting because, unlike the Soviet system, the Russian Federation has clearly made choices that do mean that there is a very, very sharp distinction, not just the obvious one, between the affluent people who can basically bribe their way out and the impoverished ones who can't, but also in terms of by not using sort of the overall conscript base. What's actually happened is precisely that people from the North Caucasus, the Buryats, the Tevens and others, various minority ethnicities, are taking a heavier share of the fighting and the dying. And it's not, I think, a direct policy. It is rather the fact of an impact of the determination to not use conscripts. Because what happens is, therefore, you rely on reservists. Reservists are people who essentially, the decent reservists, are people who've actually served as volunteers in the past. So you're using volunteer soldiers and former volunteer soldiers disproportionately. Where do you get these soldiers? Well, like almost every army, to a large extent, recruits from impoverished regions. places where, at least before the war, actually a military career seemed a pretty viable one, an opportunity to get out of your hometown, to acquire a skill, to make some money, and so forth. So this is why these people are disproportionately involved. But the interesting thing is that because Putin is still holding back from either sending in conscripts, which is actually, you know, the conscript base is much more proportionate to the overall distribution of young men throughout the military, though even that, I mean, young men, regions with high birth rates, particularly in the North Caucasus, have more young men. But he's also at the moment holding back from another mobilization wave, because it looks likely that the next mobilization wave will not only be politically unpopular, which is why Putin's holding back, but also increasingly not so much people who are volunteers, but people who are conscripts. So in other words, the actual mobilization would inevitably create short-term political crisis. This is why I think he wants to hold off, if he can, until after the September elections, regional elections. But on the other hand, ironically, do something to address the ethnic disproportions of the people in the war. So once again, sort of Putin looking for a short-term easy fix is actually feeding to a longer-term issue. Does this mean that the ethnicities of Russia will rise up and form ethnic republics and so forth? Well, no, because this is the interesting thing. If one looks, for example, at Buryatia, which, although it's called Buryatia and is sort of regarded as the titular republic of the Buryats, in fact, if you look at them, there are more Russians than Buryats living there now. And if one looks at the soldiers who have been fighting and dying, they are more likely to come from Buryatia than from many other regions of the Russian Federation. But on the other hand, there's no appreciable difference between ethnic Russians and ethnic Buryats from Buryatia. What this means, I'm sorry if this is getting over confusing and I'm managing to be excessively convoluted in this, but what matters is not actually your ethnicity. What matters is where you come from. And to be blunt, whether you come from a poor and politically marginalised region or a wealthy one. So I don't think this is necessarily directly going to create ethnic resistance to the centre, though it may, particularly in the North Caucasus. But I think instead it will contribute to regional pressures, a sense that basically the effete leaders in Moscow